This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Today's show is a little bit different because I unfortunately accidentally deleted my audio track for this entire episode, so I am recording it ahead of time and hoping to fill in what I remembered I said in between. So if you hear a few gaps here and there, that's my mistake, my apologies. One announcement that we made last week is that we are moving to a format of releasing new episodes every other week. And in the weeks in between, we'll be having some replays of previous episodes with Dr. Jen Hawk, Dr. Doug Lyle. Another announcement is that I'd like to encourage all of our listeners here at the podcast to go to Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk's new website, which is www.esteemdynamics.com. This is where you can become a lifetime member of their Living Wisdom Library, where they break down all of the information, everything that they've gathered into one nice website. You can either sign up for a monthly fee or a lifetime membership, which will include their copy of their book, Esteem Dynamics, when it does come out. So again, that's www.esteemdynamics.com. All right, so without further ado, let's try to join in on this conversation between Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast.
Oh. Yeah, great, Nathan. Oh, yeah. You can't seem to get the order right, but that's okay. That's all right.
We'll just live with it.
That's right.
As women have done for generations.
Oh, my goodness.
That's right. Life under the patriarchy. Hashtag life is suffering. I just add thanks for mentioning the website to folks, and just to be clear, like, yeah, we're going to twice a week with the podcast, but if you miss hearing from us and all of our off the rails comments that we get into, it gets even more extreme when we do our membership Q&As, which are we've been doing a couple times a month, and you can submit questions directly through the website for those too. So if you're not over there with us, you're missing out.
Nathan, also the Beat Your Genes will still be on every week. It's just that every other week we'll have sort of the best of, correct?
Right.
Yeah. Something like that. Got it. So two new shows, or a new show every other week, and then replay a good oldie but goodie on the off weeks. Good. Cool.
All right. All right. Our first question of the day is, dear doctors, I have been a proponent of wholesome eating as the guarantee of good health and optimal weight. The approach has worked great for me, but I'm still curious to know if eating high-calorie dense foods but within a strict daily caloric budget is detrimental to one's health. I have no cravings or addictions of any sort. It's almost an academic question, mostly concerning socially inflicted foods like barbecue, wine, cheese, etc.
Huh. Academic question.
Go ahead, Jen. Yeah. You're the academician.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of different questions nested inside of this question. So the first is, this assumption that you've got a strict caloric budget every day that you can. I've this has been a topic that's been coming up a lot with clients, so I just will take a little minute to talk about this. So this, you've got some program, some website that tells you, yeah, according to your height and in your perceived activity level, you should be eating 1763 calories a day or whatever it tells you. So these things are such general estimates, and it's there's so much noise in your little calculators of your strict calorie budget when you plug in, oh, I had an apple, and then I had two slices of bread, and I had a bowl of oatmeal. You could be off by hundreds and hundreds of calories, depending on how ripe the apple is and how, like, the particular processing of any kind of item. Even if you're only eating processed food with specific ingredients and nutritional facts on the back, and you're plugging that in directly, that's still subject to a lot of error and a lot of noise. So the idea that you're within this exacting calorie budget and by following that you're going to be successful long term is really sort of just a generally confused notion, and that's part of why when we talk about long-term success on a whole food plant-based diet or just a whole food diet in general, you really want to be moving more toward the what you're eating rather than the exactly how much, and trying to measure it through the arbitrary system. It's not that calories don't matter. Of course calories matter, but your perception of exactly how many calories you need and exactly how many you're getting is likely to be off by quite a bit most of the time. So that's just kind of just compartmentalized piece number one there. The second is that there's a difference between eating high calorie dense foods and the kind of things that you're talking about. So you're listing barbecue, wine, and cheese. So the barbecue, wine, and cheese are different. They're going to have different effects than something like a lot of walnuts or a lot of avocado or a lot of sweet potatoes, or depending where you draw the line at calorically dense and what we mean by that. So of course there are detrimental effects associated with specific foods. And some of the most detrimental things are going to be things like alcohol and dairy and processed meats. I don't think we need to get into all of the ways that those things can harm you on the show. In fact, there's a very helpful resource on the internet for that. My dear friend Michael Greger's website, nutritionfacts.org, has a compendium of videos that you can watch that'll tell you all about everything that you could possibly need or want to know about the detrimental effects or the positive effects of any one of those substances. So for any particular thing that you might be interested in consuming that we would identify as calorically dense, there could be all kinds of externalities and detrimental effects associated with that food. So plenty of good reasons not to drink alcohol, plenty of good reasons not to eat cheese, apart from the fact that they are higher in calories. So that's my general rant on that. Just kind of stick to whole foods that would have been familiar to your ancestors, and you're going to be mostly on the right track.
Right. All good.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Our next question. Dear Dr. Lyle, I love your show. I have a question. My girlfriend often slips into baby talk and it grates on my nerves, but I don't know how to stop it. Do you have any suggestions?
Huh.
They're asking you, so.
Yeah, that's actually a little bit tricky because obviously this sort of comes naturally to this person, and I can understand there'd be a number of reasons why it might grate on your nerves, but let's talk a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about where this may come from. I think I'm remembering the guy's name right. I think the guy's name is Eric Byrne. He was a psychoanalyst, writing, I think, in the 1950s and 60s. And I believe that's the father of transactional analysis. So, Jen, if you got a cell phone there, look it up, make sure I'm right. And transactional analysis, when it came out, it was pretty big hit in the sort of self-help communications movements in the 1960s and 70s. It was sort of bordering, it was moving away from psychoanalysis and sort of moving into humanistic psychology. So I think Byrne was sort of halfway in both camps. So this was a very hopeful, interesting, instructive, hands-on way of looking at human communication. Now, I think it has a lot of merit. And, at the time, anything that even remotely said the word child or parent you know, when I was in grad school, I just rolled my eyes and ran the other way. And this was not talked about in grad school, but it's talked about among clinical psychologists, or it certainly was at the time. I think it's sort of out of vogue now. Although people do talk about, quote, the inner child and that sort of thing. But this was the transactional analysis in retrospect, you know, probably, you know, much later, far, far after I became acquainted with EP, probably a decade after that, I started to realize, it dawned on me that transactional analysis had merit. And it would seem to be possible that you could have essentially identifiable categories of relationships that the mind would economize its computations, survival and reproductive computations, in light of what is the nature of this relationship. So, for example, if it's parent-child, the child is aware or can read cues that they've got a lot of leverage over the parents. They are extremely important. And therefore, for example, complaining would be a very good thing to do because you're likely to be able to get resources that way. And you'd run a cost-benefit analysis on those complaints, and you'd also have a memory system for how those complaints were addressed. That would be important as well, so you could modify it. But the fact that you might essentially be able to infer a category of relationships, i.e. parent-child, and what you could expect to get out of that, and therefore it would alter your communication style, that actually seemed to me to be very possible in terms of human instinctual programming. And so what Byrne did was he had little graphs, and it's PAC, parent-adult-child. So he's essentially saying that your communication is coming from one of those three roles. So in this show, everything that happens is adult-adult. So even though people may ask us questions, so they're asking for advice, it's still adult-adult. So that's how we're talking. So, but a parent-child communication is different. So a parent-child is like, listen, you know, a child is like, hey, I need your help. And the parent is, okay, let me tell you what you're going to do, or you need to do this, you need to do that. And the parent is inferring some responsibility for outcomes, etc. Children, I've actually watched people like in my office over the years, they will slip into child mode in order to try to get me to get in a parent mode so that I'll take a bunch of responsibility for their problems and fix them. Okay, so that, in other words, I'm by the way, am like... I'm like Iron Man. I'm made out of steel. There's no way that that's going to happen. As soon as I sniff it happening, my hackles go up. Okay, it's like this is, you're not slipping me into the parent mode. And I remember a therapist that I respected had a little carving, one of those little wood carvings that you can buy, and you know, with a little thing painted on it. It said, "A lack of planning on your part doesn't make an emergency on my part."
Yeah.
Okay.
Very common.
Very common. Okay.
Around the land.
That's right. And that's exactly how it is that I feel as a psychologist. So if you come to me in an emergency, I'm listening carefully, but I'm going to talk to you like an adult. It's like, okay, what are we going to do about this? Tell me this. In other words, I'm consulting. We're problem solving together. It's eyeball to eyeball. If you slip into crying on me, it's fine. I relax and wait. I don't panic the way I did my first, you know, year as a psychotherapist. It's like, oh my God, my client's crying. Oh my God, I'm failing. I'm never going to be good at this. This is a disaster. Every young therapist has this. After a while, and after I understood that crying was an instinctual mechanism in order to try to get support, i.e. drawing the therapist or the listener into a parental mode and therefore an altruistic mode, once I understood that conceptually, I relaxed. And so now when people cry, if they ever do, it's like I'm completely relaxed. I'm just letting that essentially instinctive manipulation tactic wash its way through the system, and then we relax, and then we say, okay, well, now what are we going to do about it? Let's look at our options. And we go right back to adult mode, and everything's fine. Okay, so so baby talk. Well, it just so happens I had a relationship like this way back in the day, and it wasn't good. In other words, my girlfriend also had slipped into baby talk, and that was an absolute romantic sexual deal killer. There's just no way. In other words, that what you've done is you've shifted the relationship from adult to adult to child parent. So you pushed me into the parent mode. And, you know, if parents are not weird, they're not interested in having sex with their kids. Okay. So this is, so the fact that this person, this questioner is having a, it didn't grate on me. It just sort of like, I did recoil. It was troublesome. I didn't like to hear it. It was friendly. In other words, I understood that it was friendly and it was kind of sweet, but it also was like, this is anti-sexual. And I didn't understand at the time what was happening, the role I was being put in. So I would, again, this depends upon the nature of the relationship and how long the person's, you know, you've been with the person, what you know about them, all these, there's all kinds of details. In relationships, we sometimes play what I call very open. Very, very good relationships or relationships with excellent people. You can play open. You can talk about the essentially evolutionary roots of different issues and conflicts, and you can sort of talk your way through and plan as a team how we're going to work our way around the inherent conflicts that exist in relationships. That's like A plus 4-star way of trying to solve problems. Other way to solve problems is to just to try to manage them unilaterally. And so I don't know how long this relationship is, how invested, what the person feels like about the other person in all these different ways. There's too many parameters that I don't know the answers to in order to give, you know, sort of blanket advice. I can't do that. But what I can say is that your feelings are very understandable. The other person's tendencies are sort of, I'm not sure what's eliciting it. In other words, what in their personality or what in the situation could be eliciting that behavior out of them. But in other words, why are they slipping into the child mode? Is this something that comes very easily to them? Or is there something in the nature of the relationship or their personal situation that is causing them to slip into that? In general, I'd like to play open and say, hey, listen, just to let you know that sort of slips me into a parent mode, and that doesn't feel good. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel good to me. So it's kind of sweet, but I saved this for my cat. You know what I mean? The other thing to do is to be kind of a gentle version of sharp angling, which is what it is that I do in therapy. So I let it pass, and then I don't respond to it in kind. In other words, I don't let it pull parental behavior out of me. I sharp angle and like, hey, well, what are we going to do? It's like, boom. Like, oh, we didn't get let's see what we can do to help you. You're not going to get that kind of paralinguistic action out of me. I'm not going to make those kinds of soothing, I'm responsible, I'll take care of you sounds. It's not going to happen. What you're going to get is you're going to get pleasant but adult-to-adult communication. And possibly a few doses of that might wake the person up gently and realize, oh, that's kind of not allowed here. And so that would be the way to do it if we weren't playing open. So if we didn't want to let them know conceptually what was happening and why it bothered us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lyle. Yeah, at first when I heard this question, I thought it was about baby talk, as in the girlfriend wants to have babies, but now I realize it's not about that.
Right. Oh, got it. God. Yeah. No. Oh, yeah. Nathan. Yeah, your worst fear, Nathan. There you go.
That would more than grate on your nerves. It's interesting though, like it, you know, it's incest is such a taboo, right? It's such a taboo, but it's a taboo for a good reason. It's for these evolutionary and genetic reasons. And I think that we have a lot of built-in little mechanisms that can kind of flag that alert in our nervous system to let us know this isn't somebody that we should be having a sexual connection with. And so you know, there's the wonderful studies of the kibbutz, the Israeli kibbutz, where they all grow up together and they're too close to each other and they're all supposed to, you know, get together as adults and have families, but they can't because they think of each other as siblings. And probably a lot of that was encoded in the way that they spoke to each other and everything else. So I think some of this, I mean, what you're relaying about your own experience in your own relationship is that it does, it can throw that little switch, and that sort of that you, if someone is approaching you from that child to adult position, it's disturbing for good reason. It's tapping into very well evolved anti-incest mechanisms that
God.
The nervous system will keep
freaking brilliant
robust.
God that is great, Jen. I don't know that anybody's ever had that thought in evolutionary psychology. Fantastic. God, that's great.
Oh,
terrific.
Okay.
No, I can't. I mean, that's it. In other words, I was just saying, hey, well, I sort of tripped over it. In other words, the parent-child.
Yeah, I basically heard you say, yeah, I just feel like I was saying what you were saying in a different way. But yeah, that's what it seems to be getting at the heart of for me. Is a little protective mechanism to keep you from mating with your children.
Yeah. God, that's great. Yeah. Terrific. Yeah.
Eric Byrne probably didn't realize.
No, I don't think so. It's all right. That's all right.
Yeah.
All right. What else we got, Nathan?
All right. Dear doctors, thank you for the podcast. I'm wondering why we're having so many beautiful women in Russia, but much less handsome men. Is there any explanation?
That's it. Jen can answer that. I'm sure
this
she knows.
I love some of the questions that come through. It's like you just gotta kind of wonder. I've traveled quite extensively in Russia, so I can speak to this very directly. I think you're probably looking at specimens under very different conditions of life experience and self-presentation. So you're probably, you know, you've got equally attractive genes. Because I agree with the anecdotal observation that the women are beautiful and the men are less beautiful. but I think if you took a male and a female of the same age and the same sort of exposure to the difficulties and vicissitudes of a rough life in Russia, that you would find them of similar
vodka.
So I think
And cigarettes.
Yeah, vodka and cigarettes in particular. Yeah. I mean, the epidemiological data on men in Russia is really brutal. They're sort of the shortest lived males in certainly, I mean, it's there's always a
in civilization,
whether we're calling Russia the developed world or not, but yeah, I mean, these are hard living men, and it's mostly self-inflicted. And so if you run into a male in Russia who's, you know, older than 18, he's gonna have subjected himself to some really difficult and brutal aging processes, and the women do too to some degree. But you know, you're probably not in your vision of a Russian female is of the 19-year-old model. It's not of the 50-year-old grandmother, because you're not seeing images of her in the media. You're just not. That's not what comes to mind when you think of Russian female beauty. But the young men are probably, you know, before they run into all the vodka and cigarettes and hard living and military service and everything that they put themselves through, are genetically similarly situated. So that would be just my general take on it, that it's got a lot to do with environmental exposure, and just your perception is more skewed than you realize that it is, because you're looking at Russian adolescents when you're talking about Russian women. And you're looking at the, you know, most Americans, the only Russian women that they're coming into contact with is images of models. And obviously that's the nines and tens anyway. And there's just not the equivalency with the Russian men that you're going to encounter in most pop culture forms.
Yeah. I mean, because there's RussianBrides.com, and you can look at pages and pages and pages. But, you know, I've never looked at Russian husbands.com.
Yeah. Yeah. Not the same kind of market.
Oh, my.
I could tell some stories. We'll save those for the member Q&A over at the website.
All good. Oh, my goodness. All right, Nathan, what do we got?
All right, our next question. Dear doctors, on page 6 of Blueprint, Robert Plumman states that the heritability of weight is 70%. Is this statistic a byproduct of our modern food environment and therefore an explanation of the obesity problem? How would the heritability of weight differ in a Stone Age environment? How would it differ if we measured a cohort from, say, Chef AJ's group? That word heritability is also confusing. Please explain.
Yeah, well, you got good reason to be confused. There's a few too many things in here in this question to explain them all. So let me try to simplify and give some degree of clarity here. The heritability, what that word means is how much of the variance in a population's phenotype is due to the genotype. Okay, well, what do I mean by that? In other words, in any population, there is variability on whatever it is that you're measuring. So suppose it's height. So in the United States, the average female is about 5'4". Standard deviation is about 2 inches. So it's actually more like maybe 2.5 or 3 inches. So that would mean that about 70% of women are between 5'1 and 5'7". So there's that's the variation. Now we would say, okay, well, what is responsible for that variation? Now you could imagine if the species were somehow different or nature was somehow different, that it could have been, for example, gee, how much protein did you eat in your first 2 years of life? That it might have been if you ate a lot of protein, that made you a 5'8" female. And if you didn't have hardly any protein at all, it made you a 4'11" female. So it might have been that protein intake was the variable or was the causal agent that was responsible for the variance that we observed. If that were true, let's suppose that it were entirely what was involved, then that would mean that the heritability coefficient of height was zero and the environmental influence was 100% of the variance. In other words, basically, you could simply find out how much protein did somebody eat in the first 2 years of life, and you could say, ah, well, that young girl is going to turn out to be 5'6" because she had, you know, a 70th percentile intake of protein in the first 2 years. So heritability is about how much of the outcome of something that you see is due to genetics as opposed to due to environmental influences. Now, we know, for example, height is due overwhelmingly to genetics. So it's not entirely due to genetics, because if, in fact, you do starve children when they're young, they're not going to grow quite as tall. So there is environmental influence on height, but not very much. Now, interestingly enough, if we were to go back 150 years, we're going to find out that environmental influence on height was more than it is today. And that's because back in the day, some people there was a lot of malnutrition. So some of the variance that you saw in height 150 years ago, obviously, the most of the variance that you saw was genetic, but not all of it. So there was a substantial portion of the variance in height had to do with childhood nutrition. Now, that's not going to be true now. And the reason is that now there isn't anybody that is starving in the United States. worldwide there would be, but not in the United States. So in other words, young children from ages 0 to 12, they're all getting plenty of calories. There is no macronutrient shortage of people in the United States. As a result, that means that the genes are now far more, a greater percentage of the variance in the outcome of height than they ever have been before. So if we were to go back 150 years, it was probably the case that the genes were 75% responsible for your height, but environment had 25% of an impact. In other words, it was still a substantial impact. You might have been very tall, but it turns out, oh, you only wound up a little above average because you were darn near starved to death. That was probably a fairly common occurrence in 1850. So that is not true today. So over time, we're going to find out that the environment has a less effect and that the genes have more, okay? Now, in that case. Now, we could also find out that it could go the other direction, and I think it has. So it's going to turn out that, so if we were to look at people's, let's not look at their weight. I'm not so much interested in people's weight. Plowman, it's easy to measure weight, but the problem is that saying that genetics have, they said 70%. If you look later in the book, it's actually 80. So that's because it's 70% over the lifetime on average. But guess what? If we wait long enough and we wait till you're 50 or 60 years old, it's going to turn out that the heritability is actually 80%. Now, why is that the case? Sorry, Jen, I'm wandering. I'm trying to sort of explain a complicated statistical problem here.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah, so the reason is that, first of all, weight and genetics already have a natural relationship because taller people are going to weigh more than shorter people. So there's already a correlation coefficient of probably 0.2 or 0.3 that just has to be in the game that has nothing to do with how fat anybody is. So we're not really that interested. So that's a sleight of hand that comes up in Plowman's reports here that you can get a little confused about and kind of not separate out. So the fact that over time 80% of the variance is associated with genes, of 20 or 30% of that has to do with just sheer physical size of the humans. So now we're going to get down to the fact that what is the correlation coefficient between genes and excess fat stores on the organism? Okay. Now that's probably going to be 50, 60, 70% genetic. It's probably going to be 20, 30, 40% environmental. It's going to be a lot genetic in the sense that two people of equal basic size eating exactly the same diet, if that diet is naturally a very rich diet, one of those people is going to be 40 pounds overweight. The other person might be 10 pounds overweight. So the genes are going to be responsible for the difference between those two. The environment, however, is taking those two different people, two people very, very similar genetically. One of them eats a very rich diet. The other one eats a very lean diet. One of them winds up 40 pounds overweight. The other one winds up 0 pounds overweight. That's environmental. So the question is, when we look at the population statistics of the United States, if we look at the genes and the way we can tell the impact of the genes is by looking at monozygotic twins in particular. So if we take two identical twins and we watch them go, we're going to find out that early in life, they may their fat storage differences between them may be pretty similar but not super similar. So they might correlate, for example, the genes might be responsible for 50 or 60% of the variance by your 20th birthday. And so everybody says, well, the environment has a huge effect. It has half of the variance. But it's going to turn out that if we watch these people for succeeding decades, by the time we reach 60 years old, they're going to be extremely similar in how much excess fat they have on their bodies. The reason is that their diets are going to be very similar finally over time. In other words, pretty much everybody is eating a very similar diet. And so it's no surprise that if people are eating a very similar diet and you have significant genetic diversity in the population about fat storage, that the excessive high fat, high calorie diet is going to essentially make a very profound difference, or it's going to spread out the scores. In a Stone Age village, the difference between your thickest person and your thinnest person might be, say, two women, it might be 15, 20 pounds, because they're both eating a diet that's appropriate for the species, and therefore their weights are staying within a very normal, healthy range, one of them a little thicker than the other. But if you superimpose on those two different genotypes an extraordinarily rich diet, one of them may wind up 0 pounds overweight 50 years later. One of them may wind up 100 pounds overweight. So the extraordinary diet over time will cause a further dispersion, and therefore it's going to be more of the genetics of the situation are going to look even more powerful is what's going to happen. So I just realized at the end of this diatribe, very few people are going to be able to probably follow all the parts here. So that's I knew it was a tough question when we started, but I'm not realizing how tough it was till I'm done. So the answer to your question is this, that the genes are enormously determinative of people's weight, but that doesn't mean that they have to be. Okay, they are scientifically, because the pleasure trap and the modern food supply is so ubiquitous and so forceful on human behavior that pretty much everybody in the population winds up eating a very rich diet. With a very rich diet, the genes really reign supreme when dictating the variances. The person who's 150 pounds overweight right now is not behaving much differently than the person who's 25 pounds overweight. Those two people are eating almost exactly the same foods, but the genes are causing an extraordinary dispersion under a bizarre set of circumstances that they were never designed to face. Those two people eating a similar diet in the Stone Age, one of them, they would both be very healthy and fit. One of them would simply be 20 pounds heavier than the other one. So in the modern environment, the genes are looking like a this is why when even though we explain that the genes are have enormous influence on your weight, it doesn't mean that it is not genetic determinism in the fact that you can't escape it. It just means that the influence of the genes is profound, and therefore you have to do quite extraordinary things with your diet, i.e. get your diet completely away from the norm in order for you to not be captured by that mathematical tide.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lyle. Yeah, it seems like the crux of this question just lies in the definition of what heritability is. Would you be up for discussing the definition of heritability, Dr. Lyle?
There's actually mathematical definitions, but there's a way that it's calculated out of data sets, but that's beyond this discussion. Hopefully people get a feel for this from that answer.
Plowman gets into that pretty in depth as well early in the book. He mm-hmm. really describes what is precisely meant by heritability and why it's not as simple and straightforward as it seems. So yeah. If people are really interested, and this wasn't enough of a deep dive for them, they really should just go to the source and read Blueprint, because it's worth doing. Yeah.
All good, Nathan.
All right. Thank you. Our next question. Dear doctors, what's up with corporate jargon? Things like, quote, could you action this item, end quote? Buzzwords like synergy, being told to, quote, think outside the box, and all the needlessly fancy job titles and the like. I realize it's bound to be several things, maybe conferring status cheaply, trying to motivate by conveying positivity, obfuscating to avoid concrete promises and cover asses, trying to sound smart, adjusting language use to match the in-group. Am I mistaken or missing anything? Where does this jargon come from? Is it perpetuated by business schools or the fanciest companies? Am I penalizing myself significantly if I don't go along with all this BS?
This is a good Jen question.
Oh my God, I love this. This is giving me PTSD from all of my various jargony environments that I've been part of. It's not just the corporate world. I think corporate jargon has its own little, you know, yeah, some of those terms are just barf inducing, like synergy, think outside the box, let's put a pin in this and come back to it later. Like there's so many of these things, but they are just as common in the nonprofit world. When I worked, you know, for years in the nonprofit world, it sort of has its own overlapping set of jargon. And of course, in the academic world too, it's even worse. So the academic world is, its own language, and certain sections of it have their own specific sub-language. This is part of what gives postmodernism some of its magical power to confer this kind of, it's such a high bar to speak postmodernism fluently, because it's such an insane, bizarre, counterintuitive way of talking about and thinking about how things fit together, that this questioner is really starting to tap into a lot of what's going on here, is that the power that you feel of the mystical access to being able to converse in this insider language is very much an in-group signal. So I think that's probably the main thing that's driving the proliferation of this kind of language across different spaces, just, you know, whether it's corporate or nonprofit or academic or anything else. The other thing that you're touching on in the question that I think is a very big deal is the obfuscation, and we're avoiding any kind of explicit commitment, and we're not going to call things by their actual names. We're going to agree on these proxy names that we can give it, which relates to the indirect way that we're really in the business of perpetuating the idea that we're trying to solve a problem. We're not in the business of solving a problem. We're creating a market to perpetuate our job security, and by doing that, you can't speak about things directly by their actual names, or you risk actually solving the problem, and you can't do that if you want job security. So in all of these areas, those are the main things that I think are going on. The status conferred by insider group status, and the good village feelings that accompany that, and also the shortcut, the cognitive shortcut to identify who's not part of that group. So yes, you are putting yourself at risk of signaling out group status if you're not playing along. I've been in environments where I've been sufficiently disgusted by the jargon and sort of determinedly refuse to use it, and it does get you in trouble. It's probably never going to be brought up against you explicitly in a job review, like, Jonathan, why aren't you using synergy in our staff meetings? You know that's one of our favorite words. We really want to hear you say synergy more. It's going to be more like, it just seems like you're really not on board with our culture. It just seems like you don't have a great attitude about what we're trying to do here, and all these different ways of raising a fuss about how you're signaling out group. So yeah, I think you're definitely touching on the main components. And if you want to survive in that world and you want to play by their rules, you have to use their stupid language.
There you go.
Now, Dr. Hawk, would you mind talking to us about the personality differences between people who might do extremely well in a corporate environment and people who maybe don't like the corporate environment at all?
Oh, openness is probably a big...
Oh, yeah.
...going to just make a personality inference. I think the person who's going to chafe most in any environment that is prescriptive like that, unless they invented the language themselves, it's going to be openness. And they're going to be in exactly the same situation that I was in, which is like, you don't give me compulsory speech in any form. I don't want to be told how to think about something. I don't certainly don't want to be told how to speak about it. And if you link me thinking about and speaking about something specifically in some specific language to my success within that particular realm, I'm out of there. I'm going to go start my own cult. Thank you very much. it's just not going to work. So yeah, I think the main thing that would be driving, the successful corporate citizen is going to be not very open and very conscientious. That's just going to kind of work across the board for anybody who's operating in a system that is not their own invention.
Yeah, well, I smelled, I sniffed this in psychoanalysis, psychodynamic thinking. It's its own language, much more so than the CBT people who, in principle, are trying to be very direct and clear. And so, yeah, that was a reason why I turned away from it. In other words, I want to be clear, direct, understand, and not have, you know, secret hand signals and subtle intimidation that goes on with this sort of thing. So it's, hey, not my thing.
Oh, it's a serious aspect to it. I mean, the most experience I've had is in the academic world, where it really is like a huge part of being successful in academia is that kind of deflection. And, you know, it's also, if you don't really understand what you're talking about or writing about, the more obscure and specialized you can make the language, the less susceptible you are to somebody engaging directly with it and leveraging some meaningful critique of it. So if you really want to, you know, perpetuate an academic career, lean into the postmodern crazy, you know. I mean, if people don't have direct experience with this, they should really sit down and read some of this just amazingly purple prose that comes out of some of these critical theory disciplines. I know Dr. Lyle's read some of it and been just equally disgusted as I have. And I'm in this really unusual position because I am fluent in it. You know, I did in my early undergraduate days, I found it really attractive because I kept thinking there's got to be something here that I'm just mm-hmm. not understanding. You know, there's got to, it's so different and it's so enticing. And these people speak of it, you know, when they are fluent, they speak with such authority and such conviction. And it's
yes.
Yeah. And so I'd go to these seminars that were, you know, like critical feminism seminars or critical, any, if critical is in front of the name of the seminar,
yeah.
it's going to include this kind of bizarre doublespeak full of these vague power infused messages in this language as a general rule. And I would sit in there and I would desperately like try to parse what was being said. And I had this feeling as mm-hmm. an undergraduate that if I could just get it, then I'm on the inside, and not only that, but I would have access to this you know amazing level of knowledge and information that just is not accessible to the outside world. And that's a really, really powerful, compelling place for somebody who's status deficient to be striving toward. And so I think that's how these things are perpetuated and how they capture the imagination of successive generations. Yeah. And it took me a long time, sort of once I was in it and I sort of understood what was being said. It then took another long stint of wandering around that to realize how empty it was and how there really is no there. And everybody's talking in circles and everybody's, you know, as soon as you start to get close to talking about something substantive, it slips away into some other very abstract critique. And it's just this constant, this reproduction of empty knowledge that happens in that particular academic realm. And I saw that in the nonprofit world as well. And I've not spent time in the corporate world, but I imagine it's very similar.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. All right, our final question/comment. This is about, Dr. Lyle, your answer last show or a couple shows ago about the alien abductions. Dear Dr. Lyle, I was appalled to hear such an unprofessional answer to the alien abduction question. I couldn't believe Dr. Lyle's dismissiveness and complete disregard of anyone who may have had this experience. I was deeply concerned that a doctor would so callously denigrate an entire group of people by saying there's a good chance these people do not have very high IQs, calling them morons and idiots, and that anyone who would make such a claim is seeking status. Had Dr. Lyle done any research, he would have found that the vast majority of people who claim to have been abducted are reluctant to come forward. Many keep their names hidden for fear of being ridiculed, as Dr. Lyle so clearly demonstrated with his contemptuous comments. I don't ever comment on or about podcasts. However, I felt obligated to address the abusive attitude that was displayed in this episode by a psychologist. A little more maturity and tact would have been appropriate coming from a doctor. Dr. Lyle, what say you?
What say you?
Oh, well, you might have to seek another podcast because I'm not going to, if I don't have enough maturity and tact for you, then there's more pain to come. The truth of the matter is that, first of all, I don't know what they mean by professional. So I don't have a professional relationship with this person. They're not paying me. I'm not their doctor. I'm making comments about what I believe to be true about the world, and you can listen or not, and that's what we're here for. We're here to try to pick apart and understand human nature and human life. As I recall, this question was a comment about some Harvard psychiatrist that had done a long-term study of these individuals and then had found that there wasn't anything special or remarkable about them. And I think my point was, you know, what a fool. Like, why do a long-term study? Because you could tell pretty quick what the deal was. And this person makes a comment that, quote, the vast majority are worried about coming forward. Really? Like, that's a heck of a statement. I'd like to see them defend that empirically if they wanted to. Send me the evidence that the vast majority are worried about what other people are going to say. I don't think so. How about shine the camera on me? Let me tell all my friends. Let's get around the campfire and I'll tell you about the time. How the earth did they come forward anyway? So I think that's, I don't think so. So I stand by what it is that I said. I think, obviously, I think the average IQ of the average alien abductee is probably no better than average and probably below average. So the, you know, we could look that up. How many, let's see just how many PhDs in physics are among them. Okay. How many MDs? How many Ivy League educated lawyers? Okay. Let's just find out just specifically what the IQ is and what the IQ distribution is if you're interested. So now I think that, you know, I don't know about calling people morons. Maybe that's a little rough. But the truth of the matter is that I believe that it's exactly as I stated it, that anybody who is reporting that they've been abducted by aliens is overwhelmingly likely to be lying, okay? That they are attention-seeking lowbrows, that is what this is. Are there some individuals who had some fugue state after they did a bunch of mushrooms, or that they were sleepwalking in an altered state of consciousness that they're susceptible to and thought that they were abducted? Yeah, maybe. Okay. So there's probably a few people out there with highly open minds that actually had some, you know, otherworldly experience for a few minutes one night, et cetera. Anybody reporting it in broad daylight? This never seems to happen when the people are in the middle of their workplace from 8 to 5 sitting behind their desk, does it? Okay. It's always at night. Okay, it's always at night, right? Well, it's more likely to have happened with somebody in some kind of bizarre little altered state of consciousness, a little sleepwalker with a big imagination. So anybody would then believe it the next morning after you wake up and then is going to tell anybody under any circumstances, you know what I think, okay? Low IQ, storytelling, open to experience, and completely unworthy of any scientific investigation, past the most obvious look at the fact of who are we looking at and why are they saying this. Yeah, you show me the, you know, I don't know, you show me the guy or the girl with a PhD in any hard science, you know, show me three. There's always one wacko, okay? So you show me one of them and we're going to find out that they also spent 10 years studying the Dalai Lama and, you know, doing, I don't know, peyote somewhere in the middle of the desert for a few years. But show me the one that isn't. Show me the one that's a 10-year...
personally attacked.
Yeah, okay. Show me the... sorry about that. Show me the PhD in physics that's at the University of Iowa and is a 10-year professor. And you tell me that that guy comes forward and says that he was abducted by aliens? No. Okay. That's not who's making those reports. Isn't that curious that that's who's not making those reports? So... Now, I'll stand by that, and if that's unpalatable, oh well. Can't please them all.
Yeah, I mean, other than just my general sort of defense of openness, but I already went on the record with that, with the original question. But I would say that the one, this counterclaim that, you know, if you'd done your research, you would have found that the vast majority of people who claim to have been abducted are reluctant to come forward. So that, it's, I just wanted to pick on that for a second, mm-hmm. because that's the kind of thing that will be promoted as counter evidence. But if you look more deeply at that, you recognize how sort of imperiled a data point like that is. By its own assumptions. So the vast majority of people who come forward say that they're reluctant. Well, by definition, we're looking at people who have come forward. They've self-selected into, you know, they are coming forward and saying, I was abducted. I didn't want to tell you, but I felt like I had to. Well, that's an impression management scheme.
Sure. Right.
Like, you know, of course you're going to have some significant percentage of those people have enough conscientiousness and enough sort of sensitivity to what other people think about them that they're not. It's not the right thing most of the time to be like, oh my God, I was abducted by aliens and I just can't wait to tell the world about it. And let me, you know, where is the National Enquirer because I want to tell my story. No, you're going to signal that, you know, this was so weird and so unusual and I'd really prefer not to talk about it. But, you know, I feel like it's a significant enough event that I'm forced to believe it to be true or not. But,
so, yes.
But that is something that needs to be put under that critical lens.
Yes.
Of like, okay, that this is part of human impression management.
Yes.
It's a selected sample that has that bias built into it. The only way that we could really get at if the truth is out there, the only way that we could really know, and you're getting at it when you're talking about like, let's look across the swath of, you know, high status individuals, high IQ individuals. But if you do, you know, not a retrospective kind of study,
yeah.
like it's going to be, you know, putting out a call for everybody who's been abducted to tell their stories, but a prospective study where mm-hmm. you take a bunch of kindergartners,
right.
and you take all of the hypothetical personality and IQ and whatever circumstantial traits that you could catalog, and you mm-hmm. trace those individuals throughout the course of their lives, and then you see, are there patterns in the data that are some of those children more likely to report being abducted or not? So that's how you would actually answer the question. But there's no funding for that kind of thing because, you know, this is not a high value location for scientific research in most
sure.
cases. So it is. That's where it stands.
Here's where I stand with a lot of these things. If I get abducted, I'll tell you about it. And I'll tell it to you straight. And then I'll believe it.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.